Welcome back to the Venture Life Science Innovation Podcast, a podcast to showcase life science innovation around Texas. My name is Tu, and this is my co-host, Jeffrey.
Hey, everyone.
Today, we have Summer Babarak, co-founder, CEO, and president of Hera Biotech, an early-stage women's health company focused on commercializing the first minimally invasive diagnostic for endometriosis. Endometriosis is a common gynecological condition that occurs when the tissue that normally lines the uterus grows outside of the uterus. According to Johns Hopkins Medicine, it is estimated that 2 to 10% of childbearing age American women between the ages of 25 and 40 are affected. Symptoms of endometriosis may include excessive menstrual cramps, abnormal heavy menstrual flow, GI problems, and pain during intercourse. These women are more likely to have difficulty getting pregnant. The causes of endometriosis is still not known. Diagnosis is done using a surgical procedure to collect biopsies and then observe the tissue under the microscope. Treatments include surveillance, hormone therapy, and surgeries. Ideally, a blood test or urine test is preferred as a diagnostic tool. However, so far there's no reliable test available. Therefore, the team at Hera Biotech is working on a better diagnostic tool for endometriosis. We will hear more about the technology from Summer. Welcome, Summer.
Thank you guys so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we go into Hera Biotech, I would actually like to ask a question about you. From what we gathered, you got your degree from UTSA for entrepreneurship and business development. And since you graduated, you are a founder of a medical device company. And then you held multiple positions at Centalis Pharmaceuticals, managing clinical trials, leading the team for product development. You were also a consultant and conducted due diligence on companies seeking funds, evaluated technology potential, evaluated clinical strategy and exit strategy. More recently, you co-founded Hera Biotech in 2019. My first question is, what sparked your interest in bioentrepreneurship? And have you always been interested in science innovation?
So kind of a funny answer, I suppose. I have not always had my heart set on being in bioentrepreneurship. I went to UTSA and decided to pursue an entrepreneurship degree because I just felt like it was a really well-rounded degree program and taught you a lot about how to just spot problems and learn how to then perhaps address those with a solution. What actually got me into kind of the life science area of this was in my last year at UTSA, I had my first child and had a crazy long delivery. I was in labor and delivery for 26 hours. And
oh my goodness.
It was insane. And I wasn't allowed to like get up or walk around because they were trying to keep my child on the monitor. So after it was over, I ended up in an emergency C-section. It was just a mess. And following that, I kind of said, okay, I don't know what they were trying to figure out, but there has to be a better way to get the data they were looking for. So I just started talking to my L&D nurses that I happened to then become Facebook friends with and reaching out to OBs and chatting. And that was the genesis for my first company, which was Claresta. And that was based on a fetal monitoring technology that utilized Bluetooth to communicate the fetal heartbeat and uterine contraction to the bedside. And that's actually how I got involved with the Targeted Technology Fund and then, you know, moved as the progression that you just stated. So, yeah, that's how it all started. Just one bad experience.
Well, it's not so bad, right? There's a silver lining to it.
Exactly. Exactly. That was kind of the first time that I had really experienced a pain point. And I think, truthfully, the degree program that I was in at UTSA at the time gave me the tools and gave me the spark to say, okay, there it is. There's a problem. Now let's go figure out how to solve that. So that was, it was really interesting. And then working with targeted technology and seeing a wide variety of life science companies you know, presenting and trying to develop and commercialize solutions to problems was really fascinating. Working in their two sister companies where I did the clinical operations, I was their director of clinical operations, seeing drugs being developed and how clinical trials are run and communications with the agency. It was just really, I think, an exceptional experience and prepared me really as well as one can be prepared to start and run their own life science venture.
That sounds like a great experience. Did the UTSA business program you're in have different focuses, for example, one for bioentrepreneurship?
So when I went, the program was very early. It was really in its infancy. And so they didn't have different segments. But now this sort of curriculum has been, you know, widely accepted at a lot of different universities. And some universities even offer like certification programs, I believe, where you can do a certification program. And those typically do have kind of silos of interest where one could focus more on IT type tech or focus more on life science or biotechnology or focus more on small business entrepreneurship, those sorts of things. And so I think that there are a lot of programs widely available at a lot of really great institutions. If people are interested, I think I would say it's a great idea.
So I know both UTSA and UT Health have a tech transfer office, and UT Health actually started an accelerator program called Technovum, which helps scientists or medical doctors who come up with an idea that they want to commercialize to play a more active role in the commercialization of their product.
Right. So what you'll find is that most universities, I would say a gross majority, have a technology transfer office. And that's not something that I even was aware of until I was in the entrepreneurship program at UTSA. So most of the time, students of these or faculty at these universities or institutions have a resource available to them on campus where, you know, I think faculty are typically bound contractually to disclose innovation or inventions, but students, not always. And so I think it's a great place to start. If you're curious, if your idea has some legs, I would say find your tech transfer office and start talking.
So I attended a departmental seminar talk given by Dr. Namir Kerma, and I learned a lot about endometriosis, and that was where I heard about Hera Biotech. Can you tell us more about Hera Biotech?
Sure, absolutely. So first of all, I just have to say Dr. Kerma is great. Like, he's just got such a wealth of knowledge. It's pretty amazing. So he actually co-invented the technology that we've licensed with Dr. Bruce Nicholson, who was the chair of the biochemistry department at UT Health until recently. He stepped down, actually, to pursue commercialization of this technology. So I cannot begin to express enough how grateful and, you know, really excited we are to have such incredible inventors, you know, on board. Mm-hmm. But the way that I got involved was, so the two companies that I was the director for clinical operations for, they were sister companies. So one was pursuing viral indications and the other was pursuing all other than viral indications. And so those companies were exited in 2018, I believe. And we stayed on with them for a little while, and then the company that purchased them decided to discontinue operations in the US. They were an Australian publicly traded company. So following that, I took some time off and then kind of started thinking, okay, well, what do I want to do next? And decided, okay, I'm going to go find women's health technology. And so reached out to a lot of the big universities that are kind of notorious for having really great life science technology, and found a really sad amount of innovation happening in women's health, especially in diagnostics. And getting back into therapeutics was just something that I didn't really think was a good fit for my first run at being, you know, the lead, the whole CEO, the big thing. So I really wanted to stick closer to diagnostics or medical devices, things I was more comfortable with. And a friend actually mentioned, well, I don't understand why you haven't talked to UT Health. And it was kind of this moment like, well, I don't know why I haven't talked to him either. What a great question. So I actually contacted the tech transfer office at UT and happened upon a friend and former colleague there and said, you know, I'm looking for something. And he said, oh, have I got it? You got to get in here. You'll love this. And I was like, okay, great. So I went in and had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Nicholson and Dr. Kierma and their passion for the technology and around endometriosis and the importance of this huge problem in women's health was just so evident. And the science was really great. And so I just thought, well, I mean, you can't go wrong with great science and passion, right? Like, So, you know, we were lucky enough to secure the license from UT Health and then subsequently asked Dr. Nicholson and Dr. Kierma to come on and obviously be co-founders and work with us. And so they've been gracious enough to accept that. I don't know that that's always the case. I think a lot of times companies come to universities and they have technology available and the companies license the patent or the technology and bring it in-house and may consult with the inventor a little bit and then kind of move it on. And so I'm just really excited that we've got these guys on board. I think they're going to be really impactful. So that's how I got involved with the technology and Dr. Kierma and Dr. Nicholson. And so we decided on, well, I picked the name Hera, if I'm being honest. So Hera is the Greek goddess of fertility and family. And so endometriosis is the number one cause of infertility. And I just felt like it was really a good fit for a name. It was a meaningful name.
That sounds nice. He was very passionate when he mentioned the technology and the company.
He's so great. Like, I don't even know if you, like, he teaches Tai Chi. Like, he's so cool. Like, he's such a cool guy. I mean, they're both so, you know, I think in the traditional sense, a lot of people have this preconceived notion of people that are as brilliant as these two gentlemen are and, you know, obviously established in their careers. I mean, I feel like I certainly did. And they are just the nicest, most down to earth, cool people. Like, I kind of want to go take a Tai Chi class from Dr. Kierma. And I actually went and saw Dr. Nicholson's wife is an incredible artist. And I went and saw, she did a show out in the Hill Country and it was really incredible. So it was super fun.
I was just curious if you can go into a little more detail about how this diagnostic technology works.
Absolutely. So what's really interesting is in endometriosis specifically, there hasn't been a whole lot of research to understand the pathology of the disease. It's just been really underfunded and things like that. And so I think the complete differences in background from these two researchers really drove this forward really in a great way. So as I mentioned, Dr. Nicholson was the chair of the biochemistry department, but his whole background is in structural biology. As a matter of fact, the gene panel that we're measuring in endometrial tissue is heavily based on connexin proteins, which are structural proteins that make up gap junctions. Well, Dr. Nicholson was the first person to discover a connexin.
Wow.
Oh. So, I mean, he's kind of got the jump on everyone in this area. And these connexins have been implicated in a huge number of invasive processes. And obviously what comes top of mind when people say invasive processes is cancer. And yes, you know, they are being looked at in cancer. However, it's invasive processes all the way down to embryo implantation. A lot of people don't think about that, but little people are quite parasitic in the beginning. And so, you know, connexins kind of mediate these invasive processes. And so Dr. Nicholson and Dr. Kierma decided to come together. They came together at an oncology conference. And Dr. Kierma's background in endometriosis, a lot of people refer to endometriosis as the non-cancer cancer, because essentially you have a tissue invading where it doesn't belong and growing in lesion formation. The only difference is that it's not growing at an unregulated rate. So when Dr. Kirma shared with Dr. Nicholson this behavior of the tissue, Dr. Nicholson was like, there's got to be a connexin issue here. And so initially, as any good researcher would do, they looked at bulk tissue. And the tissue they were looking at was the endometrial lining. So that's just the lining of the inside of the uterus. That's the tissue that gets outside of the uterus and then starts growing in women that have endometriosis. And so they took, you know, tissue samples and were looking at bulk analysis. And on bulk analysis, it's pretty innocuous. It doesn't look like anything's going on. But because of Dr. Kirma's expertise with single cell analysis and microfluidics, they decided to separate the cell types of the endometrial tissue. And once you separate the cell types, all the magic happens. So these connexins, where they were downregulated in one of the cell types, they were almost perfectly negatively correlated in going up in the other cell type. So on a bulk analysis, it looks as though nothing's happening. But when you separate the cell types, you realize there is a marked misregulation.
Right.
And so that's essentially the basis of our test.
So it's just utilizing single cell technology and then running a panel of biomarkers, PCR, looking at the gene expression of these connexins.
Right. So it's a single cell PCR endeavor. So we look at all of the stromal cells and all of the epithelial cells, and then the ratio at which those connexins are misregulated gives us a binary yes, no, you have endometriosis, and there are stages of the disease. And so as we continue forward, we've been staging the disease as well based on the differences in those ratios. And so it's really exciting from the perspective of the prevailing hypothesis on how endometrial tissue gets outside of the uterus is that in a huge portion of women during their menses, some of the tissue is refluxed back into the abdomen. And no one could really figure out this happens in a huge portion of women, but why in some women does that tissue land on pelvic organs and start to grow? And in other women who don't have endometriosis, the immune system recognizes the foreign tissue and kind of goes, you don't belong here, flushes you out, you know? And so it was a seed versus soil kind of hypothesis, which was, well, so do women with endometriosis have some sort of situation happening where their pelvic organs are more susceptible to grow this endometrial tissue? And Dr. Nicholson's hypothesis, no, it's not that their pelvic organs are receptive to being invaded. It's that the tissue that's landing there is primed for invasive behavior.
Yeah, it sounds curious. Like if it's, for example, a genetic disorder that's causing that to happen. Or
yeah, like environmental factor that would affect the behavior of those cells.
Like a cancer, almost, as you mentioned.
Right, exactly. And so, I mean, unfortunately, there's just not a huge amount of research out there looking at any of those things. So I always try to equate it to, this is really the first step. I mean, you know, you hear a lot out in my field, my realm of things, you know, with a lot of attention being paid to women's health now and femtech, which is a growing segment of innovation. You know, oh, well, if men had endometriosis, it would be cured by now. I'm like, well, I mean, maybe, but men have a lot of things we haven't cured yet either. But on the alternative side of that, being someone who's been in drug development, you know, you immediately go to the clinic. Okay, well, how are you going to treat something that you can't test efficacy in? How could you even design a therapeutic to look at? You know, how no IRB in the world is going to let you cut a woman open every few weeks to see how your drug is working. It's just not going to happen. So I always, you know, with folks who maybe don't have a scientific background like myself, or just don't have a lot of experience in endometriosis or women's health, I always try to explain it like, you know, think about cervical cancer. We knew cervical cancer was a problem. It was killing people. The only way in the beginning that we could figure anything out about it was to cut people open and look and see what was going on, right? Mm-hmm. And then along comes the pap smear, because we figure out that cellular changes on the top of the cervix can be indicative of cancer formation. And so along comes the pap smear, and think about all of the things that have happened following the pap smear. We learned so much about cervical cancer. We even now know that a huge portion of it is caused by HPV, and we have a vaccine for that. None of that would have come to fruition had we not had the pap smear. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of that Pandora's box of, you've got to first be able to detect it. Then you've got to be able to monitor progression. Then you can really have a good understanding of what's happening on a cellular level during the disease and how can we mediate that.
Mm-hmm. So everything has a process, right? And the process for treatment is diagnosis.
Right. You have to diagnose it before you can treat it, for sure. And so I think that that's one of the really exciting things about our particular piece of technology is, you know, if we can do what we say we can do, and if we can prove that clinically, then we're really the first therapeutic enabling diagnostic.
Yeah, that's amazing. How far along exactly is the technology right now?
So we have a material transfer agreement with Madigan Army Base. And obviously we are in UT Health Science Center. So to date, we have only been funded with grant funding, not NIH, so family grants, and the Endometriosis Foundation of America gave the guys a grant. And so we've completed our assay in 12 patients. I hesitate because we just had 3 more samples come in today, or Dr. Nicholson is going to be grumpy the next few days because he's going to have to do all those samples on his own. So what we're doing now is we feel that we have sufficient data that we're raising our first round of funding. And so we're looking for $1 million of funding to do a 60 patient proof of concept study to really get tight parameters around patient population who's appropriate for this. Because there's always people that just aren't appropriate, you know, optimal sample collection time, sample stability. So one of the tricks of doing single cell analysis is the longer cells sit around, the stickier they become. Mm-hmm. And the more difficult they become to separate. So really getting a good titration on when is optimal so that we know what our shipping procedures need to be for our samples, and then specifying sample size. So that's all going to kind of be fleshed out in that first 60 patient study that we're looking to fund now.
Very cool. Very cool. So I guess we'll segue a little bit and talk about your background with medical devices. As you mentioned before, your first startup was a medical device related company. I was just curious what the process was like for commercializing a medical device.
Sure. So oddly enough, where we are now is we're considered an in vitro diagnostic, right? And I think most researchers would, I think I was even surprised to learn that in vitro diagnostics are regulated in the same way that medical devices are regulated. And so it's really interesting to me because you have different classes of medical devices. This is the same way that they look at in vitro diagnostics. It's based on, if you're going to be a class one medical device, kind of the classic example is you're a Band-Aid. If you think you're going to get class one, then you can't be anything more than a Band-Aid. You can't even be a medicated Band-Aid. You're just a Band-Aid. Like, that's it. Then you kind of have a really broad category of class two devices, which are a little bit more invasive. So for example, taking a tissue sample, taking a swab of something, you know, really it has to do with fluid collection, tissue collection, or putting something into the body, right? Mm-hmm. And then you go into class three devices, which There you're talking about implantables, you're talking about devices that go into the body that should something go wrong, this is a catastrophic situation. So those sorts of things would be regulated as class 3 devices. With diagnostics, it's kind of the same game. And then you go to the FDA with what they, it's a 510K is the way you get cleared as a medical device. And then there are a lot of other categories that fall into there. So 510K devices have predicates. So there's something out there that we can compare ourselves to, you know, so that it's basically you're familiar with what we're doing, but we're doing it in a different way, but we're comparable to this. And then you have devices that go out there and there is no predicate. There's nothing happening out there. And that's called a de novo application. And so it can get really complicated really fast. Luckily for us, the FDA recognizes that with in vitro diagnostics, a lot of these highly specialized laboratories are quite capable of developing diagnostic assays that could be quite useful clinically. And so there is a subset of in vitro diagnostics where you can commercialize under something that's called a laboratory developed test or LDT. You know, if you're looking at commercial enterprises out there that have really done well with this, Everly Well is a perfect example. Everly Well goes direct to consumer, collects urine or saliva or whatever, and runs diagnostic tests in their lab. And so they've done a really, really good job of creating this whole market around it, right? Mm-hmm. So that is our initial strategy for Hera, is to go out as an LDT. The clinical trials required for that are much smaller. The caveat is everything has to be done in a single lab. Mm-hmm. So if I wanted to do this in a bunch of different labs, I'm forced into the 510K. We intend to pursue 510K, but not till after we get LDT.
Okay. So you can always transition to the 510K afterwards, is what you're saying?
Sure. So, I mean, the FDA is going to welcome applications for anything. I mean, they want to regulate anything that they possibly can regulate. And that's a noble cause, right? Because it keeps us all safe, or at least to the best of their ability. But they also recognize we can't possibly regulate every test that every lab could come up with that has some just very small difference that's now called a proprietary test, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of the parameters that they've put on that. Well, if you're only going to do it in a single central lab, then you can go under this LDT strategy. Now they can show up at your door anytime and say, actually, we think what you're doing might need a little more regulation. And that's fine. But from the standpoint of the company, going the route of LDT is the most expeditious path to revenue, because I'm not sitting in a 510K holding pattern. These things can be quite time consuming. And so for the investor's sake and for the company's sake, we're going to do LDT first, get into clinics, start generating revenue in our lab, and then utilize that revenue and the data that we're collecting on those revenue generating activities to support our 510K submission.
That sounds like a good strategy.
Yeah. So then that means the patients would have to be local?
No, they don't have to be local. Okay. I just have to be able to get their samples
okay.
in time.
I see.
Which is why those shipping parameters and sample stability is going to be so important.
Right.
But the good news is being in the center of the country helps a lot of that. You know?
Yeah, that's true.
So, and we're not in the Antarctic, like we're not in danger of these things, you know, freezing somewhere, getting the only, I think the worst thing that could happen is they could get stuck on a loading dock somewhere in August. So again, those will be things that we'll have to plan for.
Speaking of being in the center of the nation, how do you see the medical device startup space in Texas and in San Antonio?
Well, I'll be honest. We're not a hub. I spend a lot of time figuring out what central time is versus what they've proposed the meeting in Eastern or Pacific time. So it's a bit challenging. you know, I try to represent well when I'm on these calls and say, hey, there's a third coast, guys. We're down here. We're really exciting, by the way. But honestly, I think, you know, looking at it, if I put my opportunistic business hat on, like, holy cow, if you're looking for some really great technology to start a company around, we have a lot of it. And it's just undiscovered because we're not as well known. We don't have all of these really exciting, you know, life science companies that have done all these crazy exits. And so we have phenomenal technology waiting for companies to be started. But I will say, you know, maybe not so much Texas, but I would say San Antonio specifically, I've encountered multiple times where people are like, oh, well, I mean, where are you going to set up the company though? I'm like, no, we're definitely going to do it here. You know, so I think it's an uphill battle, but you know, I went into women's health with a female founder. So clearly swimming upstream is not something I'm afraid to do. So I think it's interesting. I think there is a ton of room for growth, but I think that San Antonio is going to have to get out of its own way a bit in order to make us successful and really put us on the map. You know, there's a lot of things happening in Austin and Houston. Yeah. Those are the ones I hear more about. I know there's a lot going on in Dallas, but, you know, I come into contact more often with folks from Austin or Houston. And so they've really done that. They've taken advantage of the technology and they've really kind of jumped on board. They've also had, I think, to some degree, with people moving in from other places and getting, I hate the term, but quote unquote, new money, you know, in the city. I think it makes a big difference. San Antonio's wealth is very concentrated. And so I think it doesn't get deployed as often as areas where you have more dispersed wealth or younger wealth even.
I think there's a lot of potential in San Antonio. It just needs a little push. And that's the reason why we brought Inventure here. We are here to support any trainees or young professionals from various disciplines who are interested in bioscience innovation. We have interviewed many founders with a science background, but life science innovation requires collaboration from many disciplines. And we want to inspire more people from other disciplines to come together to work on commercialization of life-saving technologies. Would you like to share your experience as someone with a business background who works in the biotech industry?
Absolutely. I mean, I always say this, and I don't know if it's appropriate for this podcast, but I say it all the time. You know, San Antonio has a lot of really great ideas, and I would say I feel like at least half the time, if not more, Austin kind of looks around and goes, oh yeah, that is a great idea. We're going to go execute that while y'all think about it. And they do. They execute these incredible things. I mean, they have so many VC funds there. They have so many accelerators. I mean, it's just buzzing with activity. Meanwhile, in San Antonio, it's like you have one, maybe two. To my knowledge, we don't have a life science VC fund here anymore, you know, at least not one that's investing. Yeah. And so then it becomes about going to angel investors in the community, and they're not as organized as they are in other areas. I mean, Houston has so many angel groups. Austin has tons of angel groups. The one I can think of in San Antonio is Alamo Angels.
Yeah. Think of the same one.
You know, I mean, but I think that might be because it's the only one. So, you know, I think that we need to, like I said, get out of our own way a bit, open our eyes, be a little more risk tolerant and support some of our own ventures. You know, I think the last big wins for San Antonio were the KCI acquisition and VitaCare. Those happened, I think, before I was in college. So I'm like, you know, we need some wins here. And I think the way that we do it is we support early ventures. That's where you can make the biggest impact is, you know, supporting inventor entrepreneurs or supporting teams that have postdocs or PhD students on them, because that's and I don't mean this in a derogatory term, but that's where the innovation comes from. It's not necessarily from somebody who's been doing the same thing the exact same way their whole life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's someone challenging the system or making an observation that goes, well, wait a minute, why do we do it like this? Why don't we look at it from this angle, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that if we get a couple of wins, I mean, for goodness sake, like from my lips to God's ears, right? Like, I hope hair is the next unicorn. And then I'll start an angel fund, you know, and then I'll come on the show and be like, send all the PhD students to me, you know, but that's how you build the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Austin had the benefit of the tech scene.
Yeah.
And I think those tech investors are now looking to diversify. I mean, finding good tech and finding it early enough to where your dollar goes far enough is probably tough in Austin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the problem in San Antonio is that there's a disconnect between the different disciplines, and life science innovation requires collaboration from various disciplines, right?
Absolutely.
Such as your team. You have a business background. Dr. Nicholson and Dr. Kirma have a science background. You work together to commercialize this innovative product. And that's something that we are really trying to get the word out, especially to people with a business background, that, you know, life science innovation is something that's worth looking into, especially in collaboration with scientists. They can come up with a lot of great ideas.
Absolutely. And I think a huge component of that is ego and getting ego out of the way, right? You know, from the business person's perspective, it's like, oh, you know, these researchers and their labs, and they all think they've got this really great thing and that they know exactly what to do with it. To that person, I would say, okay, what did you do? Did you create something really cool? No. So, I mean, I don't know what good that ego does you, you know. And on the other side, you know, occasionally I imagine you do have a researcher who thinks I am God's gift to innovation. And anybody would be really lucky to have my brain, you know, which, okay, but you don't know what an asset is. You don't know how to model sales projections. So what are you going to do with it?
Mm-hmm.
Both sets of folks have to understand you have your silo of expertise. We need that. You also need this other silo of expertise. And it's mm-hmm. really important that you both can come together and trust each other and recognize the strengths of your other partners and utilize those, because it's hard enough to get a technology up off the ground and out the door, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody needs to be working towards the same goal for that to work. And so, I mean, to Dr. Kirma and Dr. Nicholson's credit, I told them early on, I was like, you know, I'm not going to pretend to be a PhD. I'm not even going to pretend to have made a good grade in biology. I mean, let's just be real. So I'm going to need you to make me sound like I know what I'm talking about. And to their credit, I gave a pitch one day, and this woman from this VC fund that I was pitching to was a PhD geneticist and started asking me very specific questions. And I was like, those are great questions. And you know, I would think that the best fit would be to get you with our scientists. And I was like, holy crap, I'm so glad I got out of that without looking like a complete idiot. You know, to their credit, they're very, I think they're incredibly humble human beings. I mean, I've sent financial projections or something to them, or a business plan portion. And, you know, they've come back and said, that seems reasonable. what is that line item? You know, and I'm like, oh, yes. Yay. Look, I get to sound really smart for a second. Hang on. Let me tell you how that works, you know? So I think it's just, it's having folks that you can have that sort of open communication with without fear of, you know, making yourself look bad or whatever. You know, it's important to collaborate. It's important to know your weaknesses and seek help, right?
Yeah. Speaking of pitches, you just recently announced that you're pitching at Founded in Texas at South by Southwest, I believe.
Yeah. So we got picked to do that. That was so exciting. It was actually The 16th. So
Oh,
Tuesday we
okay.
pitched there. Yeah, it was a phenomenal event. We actually kind of stumbled across it. We had applied for funding from the Artemis Fund, and I was hoping to pitch for them. And they said, hey, you know, we have a process for reviewing, you know, applications and stuff, but we're sponsoring this event and we think that your company might work. And so I contacted Project W, who was, you know, doing the event. And they said, oh, yeah, apply. You know, we just had to extend our review deadline because we've gotten so many applications. So you've got to get your application in here in the next 2 days. And I was like, great. I didn't have any plans. Perfect. So we were selected. They selected 12 companies from Texas that were women-founded companies. And so it was a really exceptional event. It's always, and it brought in from a ton of different sectors, right? So there was like fintech. There was fem tech, which is different. And then there was health and just some other more service-oriented companies and traditional tech companies. So that was really interesting.
And you were the only biotech company there?
As far as I can tell, that's pretty much right. I was a little taken aback by it. I was like, oh, man. You know, we've done quite a few like conference tracks where you get kind of put on this track and then you have, you know, it's like a day of pitching. And so they'll say, okay, every company has 10 minutes to pitch and 10 minutes of Q&A from investors afterwards. And of course, these are normally at like big conferences, but now they're all on Zoom. So that's been interesting. And for some reason, I think because we're women's health, we frequently get routed into femtech, which is fine. I'll take that. I mean, I think femtech's really cool. I think that we're probably not the stereotypical femtech company because we're probably more a traditional diagnostic, but we get routed where we get routed and that's fine. But pitching after some of the more traditional femtech companies has been an adventure and always fun. You know, I think one of the more infamous times that we had that happen was the person in front of us was pitching like a smart vibrator, for lack of a better term. Yeah. And so her pitch ended and there was all these questions and then it was like, okay, Hera Biotech. And I was like, wow, how do I follow that up? So let's talk about the uterus, guys. It was really, but you know, the nice thing about folks that deal with femtech a lot is I don't shell shock them at all, which is nice because I have been in those situations where people are like, did she just say uterus? Like, are we talking about female anatomy? Like, is that happening right now? It's going to be fine. We're going to make it. Believe it or not, you've been inside one. So here's the fun part. Like, we're going to revisit. It's always interesting, but honestly, every time we get to pitch, I always have my little binder next to me and I have a 3-ring binder that I think all of us probably would have used in like middle school that is just completely almost full of notes already and our round opened in January. So, I mean, it's not even like I've been pitching that long and it's crazy what you learn.
It sounds like a very fun experience though.
It can be. There's highs and lows. So I always have to remind myself because I've been on the other side of the table. And so now, you know, I'll hear people ask us questions that I have absolutely asked entrepreneurs before who were pitching to me. And I'm like, oh, man, I was such a jerk. That was a terrible question for me to have asked somebody, you know, and maybe it wasn't, you know, in the context of this person asking me, but I can hear it back now. And I'm like, gosh, that's so frustrating, you know, but it's, you have highs and lows, but I would say overall, it's so worth it. And I keep having people say over and over, and the more they say it, I guess, the more I believe it, subliminal messaging, I guess, is, you know, even if it all ended tomorrow, look at how much you've accomplished and what you've learned in the time you've been doing it. I'm like, yeah, you know what? You're right. It's crazy. So, you know, get out there and start a company. Subject yourself to this. It'll be great.
Actually, that's all the questions we have. But before we sign off, we would like to ask if you have any advice for business or MBA students who are interested in bioentrepreneurship.
Absolutely. So if you're a PhD student interested in biotechnology or bioentrepreneurship, I would say start looking for problems. Don't worry about the solution. Just start identifying problems, problems with a process, problems with a condition, problems with a treatment. Because if you have a really solid list of problems, then you have a really solid list of opportunities. Because that's really kind of switching your mind over from looking at a pain point or an area of frustration and turning that into looking at it from the perspective of this is an opportunity because I'm not the only one having this issue. That's really important. If you're an MBA student and you're interested in bioentrepreneurship, go find PhD students and start talking to them. Or, you know, famously, when I was at UTSA, we competed in a student venture competition with the device that I envisioned after all of my research from my issues with labor and delivery. I petitioned to go to the competition without a team of engineers because traditionally the business students were paired with a team of engineers who had a design prototype that they had started working on a semester before. And it was the job of the business students to come in and write a business plan. And I petitioned to go without a team of engineers because I wanted to use my idea. And I was able to do that. They said the caveat is when you get to the competition, you have to have a prototype, whether you have engineers or not. And so I literally went and hung out in the engineering building and just started randomly talking to people like, hey, what kind of an engineer are you? Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. Civil engineering. Bye. Okay, what kind of a, like, great. I'll see you in accounting. No, you know, but I started talking and I creeped out a lot of engineers. But then I found a really great electrical engineer and a really cool PhD biomedical engineer student. And we came up with a prototype. We did it. Like, it's possible. And so on the business side, if you want to move into life sciences, if you want to move into biotechnology, you've got to go find someone on the science side. On the science side, if you're interested in bioentrepreneurship or life science entrepreneurship, if you want to be part of a venture and you want to take the venture forward, you've got to go find someone on the business side. Now, if you just want to know what you can do in order to bring innovations forward, then it's really about spotting those problems and turning them into opportunities and then working with the university to patent your idea. And then a company like me will come in, or maybe not like me, and, you know, license your technology from the university and you may get to be a part of it or at least consult on it. Or at a bare minimum, you're going to make a royalty, you know, from the license of that patent. And so that's a way to be involved in it without actually being involved in the venture. But I would so encourage you to be involved with the venture. And it the earlier you can start those discussions between the business side and the science side, the better it is, because there are components that your business side is going to come to you and be like, it's really cool that we can do that. But in terms of commercial viability, it's not important that you can do that. And so it saves you a lot of time, perhaps fleshing things out that aren't important or prioritizes something that you felt like maybe wasn't as important. And you find out that for it to be a commercial product, no, this is a critical point. And so having those conversations early, I think, is always beneficial.
That's awesome advice.
Thanks. It comes from that creeping out of all the engineers. I was like, oh man, if everybody had to creep out scientists, this would be so much better. Or call me and I'll find someone for you to talk to, or I'll talk to you. I still talk to the engineers that were part of that first prototype company. They still text me. One of them he was like, I have a great idea for a mask with a UV light and this and that. And I was like, wow, okay, great. You know, so yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. That is my only social media. Or you can, you know, reach me at summer@HeraBiotech, and I'm happy to point you in a direction.
Awesome. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for coming and sharing your awesome story with us and providing us with this wealth of knowledge that you have.
Oh, I'm just so honored that you guys asked. I was so flattered.
Harabao Tech is developing a minimally invasive technology to diagnose endometriosis, utilizing single-cell qPCR to screen for a panel of genes that are dysregulated in endometriosis. If you don't have a science background but want to venture into the life science innovation space, don't be afraid to reach out to scientists and engineers just like Summer did. You'll never know what opportunities you will encounter. Well, that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and thank you for listening.